The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. The youthful and spectacular demonstrations in Hong Kong are now in their fifth month. Will Beijing come in with force? We'll hear from Senator Tom Cotton.
Hugh, I will reiterate now, as I have over the last 3 weeks, that it would be a grave miscalculation of historic proportion.
And Representatives Omar and Tlaib, our two headline-grabbing squad members, strike again.
Well, the thing that I liked most when Israel very wisely, if I might add, banned the visit last week of Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar is that all these, you know, enlightened souls in the media and the Democratic Party came out and said, this is another sign of Trump destroying America.
California continues to lead the way in governmental incompetence, clearing the way for massive voter fraud.
They found over 100,000 duplicate or bad registrations.
And President Trump is still not happy with NAFTA. He's pushing what he argues is a better plan.
NAFTA is one of the worst deals ever made in the history of trade deals. It's been a one-way street, and the USMCA is a great deal.
I am Hugh Hewitt. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 a.m. to 9 a.m. Eastern Time and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com, and let me invite you to join us now by video. And take a moment to follow me on Twitter, at Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Starting on March 31st, 2019, and continuing each weekend since, the mostly peaceful and primarily youthful demonstrations in Hong Kong continue. This was ostensibly over an agreement between Hong Kong's officials and mainland China. Hong Kong citizens could be extradited to the mainland to be tried in Chinese courts under Chinese law. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell penned an op-ed in Wednesday's Wall Street Journal telling the larger story where he argued, quote, the turmoil is the result of Beijing's systematic ratcheting up of its domestic oppression and its pursuit of hegemony abroad. For insight into this fragile situation, I turn to a distinguished military veteran and Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton. But I think the most important story in the world is the Hong Kong protest, because the most important relationship in the world is that between the United States and the PRC. What have you seen shifting? Is, in fact, it becoming increasingly likely, in your view, that as the LA Times reports this morning, China is moving towards a violent confrontation with its protesters in Hong Kong?
Hugh, I will reiterate now, as I have over the last 3 weeks, that it would be a grave miscalculation of historic proportion for Beijing to invade Hong Kong territory with the People's Armed Police or to declare martial law that would require a fundamental reassessment of our relationship. I'm glad to see so many other of my peers in Congress have come around and stated this view publicly as well. And increasingly, we get indications from the administration, too.
I think that President Xi has many options in front of him short of military confrontation. But I don't see Beijing talking about any of them. They could summon the church leaders in Hong Kong, which has fairly vibrant religious community, to talk with President Xi. He could do what President Trump suggested, go there himself. Do you see any evidence that they are trying to find a middle ground here?
I've not seen any publicly available evidence that Beijing is trying to de-escalate the tension in Hong Kong. Now, to be fair, we haven't seen any publicly available evidence that they are beginning to exert physical force against the protesters. There's been some evidence that they are using subterfuge, espionage, cyber attacks to undercut the protesters. But as you saw over the weekend, that certainly did nothing to deter the huge protests. I think probably one of the key red lines for Xi Jinping in Beijing is whether these protests gain any kind of traction and begin to be replicated on any kind of scale in the mainland.
Now, when you say a grave miscalculation of historic proportion, I immediately thought of North Korea's invasion of South Korea when the Korean War began. Is President Trump doing enough to telegraph this is a red line for America?
Hugh, I don't want to comment on what the president has conveyed privately, but we should reconsider in a fundamental way our relationship with Beijing. So a few steps that we might take is to substantially change the Hong Kong Policy Act, which is what gives Hong Kong its favored status under U.S. law. For instance, no products coming from Hong Kong today are facing the tariffs that the products from the mainland face. We ought to reconsider the kind of visas that we give to senior-level Chinese officials. We could also just say simply the trade talks will no longer go forward. These are the kind of steps that we ought to have taken after the Tiananmen Square massacre in 1989, when the geopolitical situation had changed so much from the initial opening to China in the 1970s.
Are you suggesting that if violence becomes the preferred means of suppressing the demonstrations in Hong Kong, that those 400,000 will face an exit from the United States quickly?
Frankly, this is a step we should have taken long ago. Look, I'm sure there are many fine, upstanding young students from China. Let's not be naive. A large number of them are also the children of or affiliated with Chinese Communist Party officials and People's Liberation Army officials.
As we witness a number of crises around the world, it's hard not to feel disgust by the constant wrangling between our government leaders. Two of our newer House members, Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib, did some major grandstanding as they sought to put down the president and insult the state of Israel. These two notorious squad members were denied visas to visit Israel. Upon learning that Tlaib claimed an ailing grandparent in the West Bank, Israel relented and approved her visa, which she then refused. My Salem colleague, Dr. Sebastian Gorka, spoke with Liel Leibovitz, senior writer for The Tablet. We'll pick up with a clip from Bill Maher's show on HBO.
BDS is a bull purity test by people who want to appear woke but actually slept through history class. It's predicated on this notion, I think it's very shallow thinking, that the Jews are in Israel mostly white and the Palestinians are browner, so they must be innocent and correct and the Jews must be wrong. Somehow this side never gets presented in the American media. It's very odd.
Leah Leibowitz, I never thought I'd say this. Do you agree with Bill Maher?
I think he has it almost right. And the point is this, but the part that Bill Maher gets absolutely right is the part that this is a movement to eradicate Israel as a Jewish state.
Right.
Now, it's completely legitimate for Palestinian nationalists to feel like they don't want the Jews there. It is not completely legitimate for anyone who doesn't hate Jews to support that movement. It's that simple.
You've written a piece entitled The Long History of Politically Motivated Travel Bans. Give us a little bit of context, Leah Leibowitz.
Well, the thing that I liked most when Israel very wisely, if I might add, banned the visit last week of Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar is that all these, you know, enlightened souls in the media and the Democratic Party came out and said, this is another sign of, you know, Trump destroying America. Whereas in 2014, the American administration kept out Narendra Modi, who was then not yet India's prime minister, because they didn't like his views. And every country has the right to keep out people that they believe are committed to destroying its values and culture.
Right. And doesn't it tell you something that right after that, both of these congresswomen, members of the Four Horsewomen of the Democrat Apocalypse, retweeted a cartoon. Did you catch this from this delightful individual called Carlos Latouf? Carlos Latouf is a cartoonist. And both of these women reposted one of his cartoons this weekend. This man was the runner-up. He was second in the Iranian-held International Holocaust Denial Cartoon Contest. Is there some point at which the Democrats are going to reject the anti-Semitism of these two congresswomen?
If it were only these two congresswomen, I would feel somewhat confident. Just a few months ago, these congresswomen, together with Ayanna Pressley and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and 21 others, co-sponsored a bill, which is basically a direct continuation of the old anti-Semitic blood libel. What this bill says is that Israel, for no apparent reason other than to satisfy some ancient Jewish bloodlust, is killing and torturing and arresting and maiming Palestinian children. This is something that has reached, I think, the core mainstream of the Democratic Party. We're now looking at a situation that is comparable or worse than the Labor Party under Jeremy Corbyn. It's rampant Jew hatred.
When you talk to Democrats, is there just willful ignorance or is this a strategic decision? Yes, we don't care. We're going to allow this to happen in a party that was pro-Israel just a couple of generations ago.
Well, to be fair, I think a lot of people here, including a lot of kind of serious committed liberals, are deeply, deeply troubled by it. But then the next sentence out of their mouth would be, but Donald Trump. You know, the Trump derangement syndrome that we're seeing everywhere that leads to all kinds of wacky conspiracy theories is very, very real. And I think a lot of people have lost the ability to think straight on this topic and are saying we're going to support the Democrats because Trump is so, so evil.
President Trump, after having been vindicated by the Mueller report, continues to get flack from the press. Why? One complaint. He's been criticized by the media for not spending adequate time with him. But this week, he had a lengthy conversation with the White House press corps as he was leaving aboard Marine One. I spoke about this negativity from the press with Mike Allen of Axios. We get more out of Trump on a walk to the helicopter than we got out of President Obama in a formal press conference in terms of number of questions. He used to take like six and answer them for 8 minutes at a time. Doesn't the White House press corps at least appreciate this about the president?
Well, of course, reporters always love sound from the president, and you're right about the range of topics.
Well, I haven't said whether or not I would, but I would say NAFTA is one of the worst deals ever made in the history of trade deals. If you look at NAFTA and you take a look at what it's done to our country, thousands of factories closed, millions of jobs, it's been a one-way street. And the USMCA is a great deal. The unions love it. The farmers love it. Everybody wants it. The farmers, above all, love it, especially the American farmers. Our farmers love it more than the other two sides. They love it.
So now talk to me a little bit about the difference also. I know Steve Holland. I've traveled with him. I know some of the other people in the White House press corps who travel with the president versus White House correspondent land, because I think the folks traveling with the president, and this is not an aspersion on anyone, I just think they're much more meat and potatoes journalists, and they just ask a whole bunch of questions about headlines. What do you think, Mike Allen?
Well, no, when is a good question, and when reporters have the president, especially when he's been out of D.C. for 2 weeks, there is a lot of news of the day. And you can argue that that's one of the reasons that the president likes it. And there was a tweet about this yesterday saying the president gives me illusion of being out there, but you're not going to get any in-depth, sustained follow-up. He's able to touch on a lot of issues, which is what he likes to do. It's a little, you started with Jimmy Buffett, and it was sort of his Trump buffet.
Yeah, but Axios AM this morning, what big thing, CEOs, America's new politics, issues haunting CEOs during the Trump era, no massive companies won't pull out of China, and then heavy emphasis on what CEOs are thinking. Why, Mike Allen?
Businesses have been on the record as saying that their chief end was shareholders. But now, for the first time in this new statement, they're now saying that we also have a duty to our community, to our suppliers, to our employees, and then shareholders. That's a big difference.
Our program is coming in today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They are preparing grounded leaders who are impacting public policy and serving in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up.
Our national defense is obviously not a jobs program. It is more about securing the strength of our defense industrial base.
The state of our military when the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. Recently, I posted my op-ed in the Washington Post titled, "The Navy Needs to Rebuild." Predictably, I got hammered for it by some in the liberal media. But military watchers, especially those with an eye on the state of our naval fleet, realize that I am right. I confirmed this with Congressman Mike Gallagher, himself a former Marine officer and a current member of the House Armed Services Committee. While you were gone, I published an op-ed in the Washington Post that said, "The Navy needs to build its ships in Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan." And I premised that, though I did not put it in the column, my bad, that everybody knows we need to go from 290 to 355. And if we had done that seriously, the Navy would have been building ships in Wisconsin, in your district, in Michigan and in Pennsylvania. I've been attacked by people in the Navy, by Paul Krugman, by people saying I was advocating the Navy as a job program. I wasn't. I was advocating a 355-ship Navy that would absolutely have impact in your district. Was I wrong?
You were not wrong. Our national defense is obviously not a jobs program or about securing states that the president won in 2016. It is more about securing the strength of our defense industrial base, which is incredibly fragile right now. We have a defense industrial base to produce the weapons and ships that our country needs to defend itself. But since its World War II peak, the arsenal of democracy has been in steady decline. I actually wrote about this a couple of years ago in Wars on Iraq, and in its peak just before D-Day, the American defense industry was producing 5,000 aircraft per month. This year, including helicopters and drones, the Pentagon requested less than 400 aircraft. And so I did not see you arguing for a jobs giveaway. I saw you arguing for the health of our defense industrial base, and more importantly, for the geostrategic imperative of having a much larger Navy. And as always, I'm in complete agreement with you on the need to grow the fleet to 355 ships ASAP. And I think your column rightly emphasized the sense of urgency we need to have, not just in terms of meeting the Navy's stated goals, but in complying with the law. We actually put this into the National Defense Authorization Act that we must get to 355 as soon as practicable. So getting to 355 is not just a recommendation, it's the law. Unfortunately, we've seen a number of speed bumps, including Admiral Moran's departure right after his confirmation. But the good news is the Senate has now confirmed Admiral Gilday earlier this month. He'll be taking office in September, and the Navy had been waiting on publishing its new force structure assessment until the next CNO had arrived. Well, now we have a new CNO, and my hope is Admiral Gilday moves swiftly next month to get over that finish line.
There is an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal by the Senate Majority Leader, We Stand With Hong Kong, in which he writes at the conclusion, every trading nation and democracy that values individual liberty and privacy has a stake here in the Hong Kong standoff. Their choice is not between the U.S. and China, but between a free international system and internal oppression, surveillance, and a modern vassal system. Wow, China seeks to impose. Very tough language, and it gets tougher. Is everyone trying to signal the PRC? Will they listen? Do not use violence in Hong Kong.
I hope so. I think that's the right message. That's a key point that China is not interested in having allies and partners as we are. They want tributary and vassal states that they can dominate. Their history suggests that, and their current rhetoric suggests that. I agree with the op-ed suggesting that Hong Kong is a test for the free world. It is a special administrative region with special protections that mainland Chinese do not enjoy. And we once hoped that the liberalism of Hong Kong would spread to the mainland, but instead the opposite has happened. Democracy is not spreading. It is being strangled.
A few years back, the state of California embarked on a project that made thoughtful citizens, of course conservatives, cringe. Dubbed Motor Voter by then-Governor Brown, the plan was launched to turn over mass voter registration to the Department of Motor Vehicles, the California DMV. Even then, was the object of ridicule for its bureaucratic bungling. Recently, the Los Angeles Times did an in-depth expose of the program. It was, predictably, scandalous. Brian Whitman and Jennifer Horn, my Salem colleagues in Los Angeles, turned to Pete Peterson, Dean of the Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. From AM 870, The Answer.
Obviously, there have been a lot of people who take issue with this, Pete, and I'd actually turn to you. Motor Voter seemed like a bad idea when they introduced it because anybody in California who applied for a driver's license was automatically registered to vote. The snafu is that everybody who gets a driver's license, not all of them are legal citizens or residents of California or of this country for that matter. So what's been the problem so far? And tell us why this all started.
Well, it really goes back to the beginning of the program and what the Ernst & Young audit found, which was commissioned by the governor's office, reported by the LA Times, as you say, is that in this last round of reviews, not even looking at all of the registrations, just looking at a snapshot of them, they found over 100,000 duplicate or bad registrations that had come through the motor voter system. And this is just one of a number of different stories. I don't know if you remember, even going back into January and December of last year, the LA Times did a terrific expose of the problems that went into the implementation of Motor Voter back in 2018 and the amount of pressure that then Governor Brown's office put on the Secretary of State's office to implement Motor Voter registrations before the April primaries. And it seems like not only do we have bad process, I mean, there just are some things that when you go into the DMV, the way that they've asked you questions about your own voter registration are very confusing. So these could just be issues of people being confused in the DMV and pushing something that they're eligible to vote when really they're not.
for this particular thing, there is a lot of question as to whether or not there are people who are being registered legally or illegally. But with the duplicate votes, these are people who were already registered to vote and then were registered again at the DMV, right?
Right, that's right. But we have both of those problems, right? I mean, the motor voter has also registered people who were ineligible to vote. There was a story in Real Clear Politics going back into January, which found thousands of people ineligible to vote. The SACB did a great investigation as well and found that there could have been 1,500 to 2,000 people who voted illegally because they had received a positive voter registration through the DMV.
You talk about duplicate registrations, often the problems of motor voter. Because when I first heard motor voter here in California, I thought, oh, great, because I, you know, like you and most Republicans I know, want everyone to vote who should be able to vote. It's important.
Absolutely.
So if the problems are duplicate registrations, and if the problems are also illegal registrations, well, in this great big motor voter bureaucracy and computer system, why can't programs be built into these systems to immediately identify and eliminate an illegal registrant or a duplicate registrant, Pete Peterson? Why throw the baby out with the bathwater?
No, I absolutely agree. I mean, this is federal law, motor voter. So that is not going anywhere, nor should it. But I think what we've seen in the California implementation of it was there was a rush to implementation to try to get as many people registered to vote before the April primaries. And that has resulted in some serious implementation problems that I'm in agreement with a couple of the Republican legislators up in Sacramento and say, let's just pause the program and make sure we build in those firewalls exactly as you say.
So I guess the question is, we know that there were duplicate registrations, but did any of those result into bad votes?
Well, we don't know, right? And I would say it's very important that we make a distinction between voter fraud and bad voter rolls. And what we have here is a real bad voter roll problem. The problem comes, as the SACB reported back earlier this year, that there may have been people who voted illegally, but we just don't know. The number is somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,000 to 1,500, they surmise.
For more of this conversation, go to townhallreview.com. Our podcast is sponsored by Alliance Defending Freedom. ADF provides help at no cost to those whose liberty is being violated, but they can't do it without your help. Call 800-691-8969. That's 800-691-8969. Or visit townhallreview.com. Coming up.
Today's progressive is quite different from the progressive 100 years ago. It was trying to bring Shakespeare and the ancient Greeks to the working classes.
A high school reading list upgrade. Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt continues in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Mark Bauerlein is senior editor for First Things Journal and a professor of English at Emory University. He's also a consultant to the state of Florida, where he advises on the high school reading curriculum. His recent reading list has been criticized by some teachers because his opinion is that contemporary books should not be a part of it. Seth Leibson, heard daily on 960 The Patriot in Phoenix, spoke with Mark.
We're going to talk about reading and high school reading. Basically, it looks like, what was it, the state of Florida put out? You tell the story here, but basically, you got in an argument with some folks for saying high school reading lists should include very little contemporary literature. I'll let you take it from there.
Sure. I mean, the state of Florida, they're redoing some of their standards, redoing some of the Common Core work, and they just check with me about high school English reading standards, and I'd worked a little bit on Common Core. And when I worked on Common Core, what I was pushing is what I always push, and that is a canon of great literature that everyone reads. And it is very important that we have all students reading a core of the same thing. It's one of the things that gives a culture, a society, glue. People have a common inheritance, and one of those things is a literary tradition. So I saluted the governor and the head of education there for including a reading list in their revision of the standards, and I gave them a quote in the press release, and some of the teachers said, this is awful. There isn't enough contemporary material here. Some of this material has racist and sexist elements to it, and we need to have readings that are going to speak to the experience of all different kinds of people, LGBT and African American and so on. And we've heard this argument many times before.
Mm-hmm.
And my take on things is that we begin with the classics. We begin with the great works that have survived through the centuries and sometimes longer, and that every American youth deserves to have the best. That the American literary tradition of Hawthorne and Melville and Emerson and Emily Dickinson and Frederick Douglass, that those should be presented first to all students in the state of Florida and everywhere else. Well, you can imagine that strikes people as backward, old-fashioned, narrow, Eurocentric, all the old arguments that we've been hearing from progressives for so long.
It's been really interesting to see some of the pushback, because one of the things that you wrote is that a lot of the contemporary literature, honestly, it's not that good. I think you wrote it was set transient and second rate. And yeah. Inevitably, I'm sorry, but there is a reason Shakespeare is Shakespeare. There is a reason, you know, Steinbeck is Steinbeck. There is a reason Melville is Melville. And, right. You know, to your point about the common culture, isn't this something we kind of want? Aren't we kind of worried about breaking up too much here? That seems to me part of the project of education. That was the whole point of the common school to begin with, was it not?
I mean, Seth, the today's progressive is quite different from the progressive 100 years ago. For instance, the Great Books programs started 100 years ago as a progressive initiative. It was trying to bring Shakespeare and the ancient Greeks and Romans and Homer and all the rest to the working classes, so that they said, why should the upper classes be getting this and you shouldn't?
Right.
So that was the progressive vision of this kind of traditional education, bringing it down the income ladder to give people the tools to rise.
You bet.
In society. Today's progressives have a very different attitude toward the past.
And it's an attitude, but might I say the irony of that attitude is that it restores only the great literature to the upper classes, by the way.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I'll get to what is really bad about that. The progressive looks upon the past not as a site of wisdom and greatness and beauty and sublimity. The past really is a field of mistakes,
mm-hmm.
of injustice,
mm-hmm.
of guilt, of victims. And so the progressive wants to correct the past. The progressive is interested in the present and creating the future. And so the past, if it is at all relevant, it's relevant as something for us to avoid.
For the full conversation with Bauerlein, please go to townhallreview.com. Our program is coming today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up.
There was a lot of horrific murder and tyranny and industrial scale conflict in the 20th century. Actually, if you had lived in any previous century, you would have had a higher chance of dying as a result of homicide than you would in the 20th century.
An optimistic historian. When the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. If you are a news buff, you would agree that there is a lot of bad news out there. Wars, violent government takeovers, terrorism, of course, the impending ravages of global warming. Douglas Carswell is an author and former member of Parliament in the United Kingdom. He is out with a new book, Progress versus Parasites, a brief history of conflicts that shaped our world. Carswell actually thinks the world is getting better. He was a recent guest of my Salem colleague, Dennis Prager.
What is the thesis of your book?
The world is getting better. I show why it's getting better, but I also explain why the world only started getting really great 200-300 years ago. Actually, for most of humankind, life's been pretty grim, pretty miserable, because we've been run by small parasitic elites. And if we want the progress to continue, we've got to identify the parasitic elites and put them back in their box.
In the last 200 years, you say the world is getting better, and yet the 20th century was arguably the most monstrous century in human history. 100 million people, I'm talking civilians, not even war deaths, slaughtered overwhelmingly by communists, but of course by Nazis. So what does it mean?
Come back on that. There was a lot of horrific murder and tyranny and industrial scale conflict in the 20th century. But despite that, actually, if you had lived in any previous century, you would have had a higher chance of dying as a result of homicide than you would in the 20th century. It certainly didn't feel that way in the 1940s, but actually the 20th century was more peaceful than previous centuries, and the 21st century so far is more peaceful yet. I would argue that actually in the past 20 or 30 years, a lot of these improvements have become exponential. Wars, despite the horrific images we see from Syria, actually your chances of being killed as a result of conflict in 2018, 2019 are lower than almost any period in human history. Homicide rates are falling, and at the same time, people are better off. Our standard of living in the West is high, but also China. China in 1950 was as poor as China had been the year Jesus was born, 2,000 years before. And yet in the past 30 years, China has caught up, or is in the process of catching up. More wealth has been created in China in the past 40 years than in the entire period from the birth of Jesus to the death of Chairman Mao. It's quite an extraordinary achievement.
Would you ascribe that to capitalism?
Absolutely. To free exchange. China in 1978 did what the Dutch started doing in the 17th century, the Brits in the 18th, the Americans in the 19th. It allowed the productive free reign. In 1978, Deng Xiaoping allowed the communists to rule in name, but actually to take a step back. There was a program of decentralization. China became capitalist from 78 onwards, and that's why it's taken off. And India and Indonesia and some of the Asian giants have followed suit, and so they're catching up. They're starting out where the Dutch and the English began 200-300 years ago. And even a country like Ethiopia. I remember in the 1980s growing up watching pictures of Ethiopia with famine. That was a man-made catastrophe caused by communists. Since the turn of this century, since the millennium, Ethiopia has been the second fastest growing economy on the planet. It's doing incredibly well. It's got a middle class. It's going to have a very prosperous future. When you look at the mainstream media, when you look at the broadcast establishment media, they're full of pessimism. They're full of bad news. But actually, the really significant story is how human progress is becoming ubiquitous. Pretty much everywhere that isn't socialist is doing well.
How do you explain then, in light of that, every word of which I agree with, that about half of millennials think that capitalism is evil?
Do you know, I've been pondering this long and hard, and I'm a big fan of PragerU, and I watch a lot of your content. And I think, with the exception of PragerU and a few other organizations, it's because people like me who believe in the free market, we've been incredibly bad at making the case. I recently went and watched on Amazon Prime Milton Friedman's episode, Free to Choose, and it's no exaggeration to say it changed the way people in Britain and America and around the world thought. We need to do what Milton Friedman did 30, 40 years ago. We need to make the moral case for capitalism. We've not done that. And I think there are problems with our capitalist system. It's not a perfect capitalist system. It's a crony capitalist system. Here in Britain, for example, big banks are allowed to take risks and socialize their losses. That's not free market capitalism, and yet capitalism gets the blame. Here in Britain, young people struggle to find enough money to buy a house because you've got these incredibly restrictive rules on where you can build houses. They blame capitalism, but it's actually socialism that's preventing them from being able to buy a house. So we need to reform capitalism, and I think we need to be much better at making the case for the free market.
We certainly do. Your book is not just a history book. It is a warning, I presume, against the parasitical elites, because they exist
At least I can't speak for your country. In my country, parasitical elite is almost redundant.
Well, the struggle against small elites rigging society for their own benefit, it's unending. There was a time, if we'd been having this conversation in the late Roman Republic, we would have thought that progress was inevitable, that it was the natural state of affairs. If you had lived in Venice in the Middle Ages, you would have thought that life kept on getting better from one generation to the next. But actually, these periods of human progress in the past have been fleeting. They've lasted a few generations and been snuffed out. Why? Because small elites came along and rigged society for their own advantage. Now, America's got the great advantage that your founding fathers had looked back to the Roman experience. They built a Senate and a capital on the banks of the Potomac. They learned from history. They saw tyranny coming. They saw oligarchs and elites coming, and they guarded against them with an extraordinary constitution. But my country doesn't have the privilege of a great constitution. Our struggle to ensure that small, powerful elites don't take over is never ending. We were 4,000 votes away at the last election from having Jeremy Corbyn, a socialist, some might describe him as a communist, as prime minister. We are much more vulnerable to self-important elites who try to regulate and run society. It's bad enough in America, but it's a lot worse over here. Having said that, I think we're starting to see a reformation. We're starting to see, because of digital technology, because of the ability of people to form opinions without the say-so of the elites, I think we're starting to see people understand what's going on, and we're starting to see them react against it. So I'm an optimist. I think the days when big government can do these sorts of things is coming to an end. But boy, they haven't got that memo yet.
For more of the conversation with Douglas Carswell, go to townhallreview.com. Coming up.
Your candidate might be better on, I don't know, health care than Joe is, but you've got to look at who's going to win this election.
The spouse of an aging politician speaks out with the final segment of Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. If you enjoy the Town Hall Review and you are a person of faith, let me introduce you to another podcast I think you'll like. It's the Christian Outlook, and in it, you'll hear the leading voices in the Christian world engaging the issue of the day. This week, Max Lucado gives advice on dealing with the tragedies in Dayton and El Paso.
The truth of the matter is, until we get to heaven, we do not know why some of these things have been allowed.
We look at the problem.
We've got a society which tells people over and over again in every way that human life is a meaningless burp in the cosmos.
And we examine proposed solutions.
Gun control, it's a net that I wish we could swat so we could work on the real problem.
To subscribe, go to ChristianOutlook.com. That's ChristianOutlook.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. For a very long time now, we've been hearing from candidates who are vying for a nomination to become president. All are Democrats, and most are hard left progressives. Our former vice president, Joe Biden, is in the mix. And his wife, Jill, is working very hard to convince voters that regardless of what he is or stands for, Joe can beat Donald Trump. Here's my Salem colleague, Sam Malone, sitting in for Mike Gallagher. Sam's heard daily on AM 1070, The Answer, in Houston.
Jill Biden, the wife of Joe Biden, was on the campaign trail. And I know we've got to be a little sensitive. We can't be as spicy when it comes to critiques of the spouses of those running. Well, I guess we can be, but it's not like Joe Biden is a walking disaster. The guy who's leading the way for the Democrats is a walking disaster when it comes to gaffes. Jill Biden, his wife, was on the campaign trail pimping her husband in New Hampshire, just to show you how easy it's going to be for Trump. Biden is leading. And once again, it's the spouse. We're not electing the spouse, so we'll go a little easy. Jill Biden in New Hampshire said, your candidate might be better on, I don't know, health care than Joe is, but you've got to look at who's going to win this election. Maybe you have to swallow a little bit and say, okay, I sort of personally like so-and-so better, but your bottom line has to be that we have to beat Trump. Forgoing all quality of a candidate, forgoing integrity of a candidate, forgoing the creepiness of your candidate, the lies of your candidate, the socialism of your... Listen... I know you're socialist and you like Bernie or the fake Indian or Kamala had that relationship. But you know what? Joe's the guy. And you might not like Joe because he sniffs the back of women necks. And he tells, well, he told like a 10-year-old girl in Houston how good looking she was. Or he, the inappropriate, just don't worry about that. He can beat Donald Trump. Listen, Ted, listen for you for yourself.
Maybe you have to swallow a little bit and say, okay, I personally like so-and-so better. But I do
The bottom line, she says, is he has to beat Trump. Jill, I'm going to go easy on you, but how about what's best for America? How about a plan? How about continuing to make sure that America's economy is as strong as horseradish, Jill? Nah, we just need the guy who fits the suit, a la Johnny Bravo and the Brady Bunch, Greg. Forget about, you know, remaining strong. Forget about taking care of China and the inequalities and the uneven playing field of trade. No, don't worry about that. How about standing alongside our number one ally, Israel, in the Middle East, after Barack Hussein tried so much to damage it, and we see the anti-Semitism of those in Congress? No. Just got to beat Trump.
Thanks for joining us for this edition of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Follow us on Twitter at Town Hall Review. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin, producer Charlie Richards, David Posey, and Michael Cook, Adam Ramsey, Ben Brigman, and Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsors, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. Thank you for joining us.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.